A controversial novel about the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad has found a home with the U.S. publishing house, Beaufort Books. Beaufort is best known for publishing the O.J. Simpson book, If I Did It. This latest book, The Jewel of Medina, was originally set for release in August by Random House, but Random House pulled it because of worries about its subject matter. NPR's Lynn Neary has the latest.
The controversy over The Jewel of Medina erupted when Random House announced the decision to cancel publication after it was advised that some Muslims might find the depiction of the Prophet and his wife offensive. Random House said it was concerned about the safety of its employees, the author, Sherry Jones, and anyone else who might be associated with the book. Jones's agent, Natasha Kern, says they were both blindsided by the last-minute decision and immediately began looking for a new publisher.
Obviously, we want to have the book read and judged fairly, and for people to realize that, you know, accusations like that it's soft porn or whatever that now we've had to respond to are wildly untrue.
The book is due to be published in a number of foreign countries, including the UK. And today, Beaufort Books, a small independent house, announced it will publish the book in this country. Beaufort President Eric Kampman says his company is not afraid of controversy.
And of course, I did the O.J. Simpson book last year, If I Did It, which was tremendously controversial, and I got a lot of negative feedback. But the public wanted to read it.
Kampman says the controversy around The Jewel of Medina is misguided. He says it's a work of historical fiction, which is respectful of Islam.
I think it brings a reality to it that most people in the West, and particularly in America, are just not familiar with. So I think it's a boundary destroyer rather than a barrier builder.
Natasha Kern says she and Sherry Jones are pleased with the deal, which gives them a larger share of the profits and includes publication of a second book. Kern says they also received full assurance that Beaufort will back them no matter what happens.
You know, we did talk about personal safety issues for Sherry, and we're very happy with the support that will be arranged in case something does happen.
Eric Kampman says he doesn't believe the publication of the book will lead to violence, but if it does...
You hire guards. If there's trouble, I mean, what kind of trouble is there? I mean, you know, this is America. There are lots of points of view. There are lots of worldviews in this country. If this should be published, it should be published in America.
Kampman hopes to have the book out by late October. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read an excerpt of The Jewel of Medina at npr.org.
9-year-old Lawrence and his sister Jemima and mother Hannah don't come to Rome as tourists. They've escaped from London, because his mother's worried that their estranged father may be stalking them and come down from Scotland to do them harm. So they pack up a few clothes, a few toys, Lawrence's hamster, and they drive to Rome, where Lawrence's mother has some old friends and feels safe. For a while. When We Were Romans is the title of the new novel by Matthew Neal, author of several novels, including the best-selling English Passengers. He joins us from the BBC studios in Rome. Mr. Neal, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
How do you write like a 9-year-old?
I was very lucky. My parents, crazy though this sounds, actually hung on to various of my old school books from when I was that age. So I had a look at those, and that helped. I think it also helped that I first came to Rome, where I now live, at about that age. And it made a very strong impression on me. I really liked it. So I could sort of remember how I first saw the city.
And why decide to write a novel in the voice of a 9-year-old? A novel, we should explain, if it wasn't plain, is obviously treats some very adult themes.
Yes, I think it was really quite an interesting approach to fiction to have something important, something dramatic, narrated by somebody who doesn't necessarily understand it very well. Because their view on it, somehow they're going to miss some of the points, and I think that can, with luck, will draw the reader into the story because they're more alert to what's going on in some ways than the narrator themselves.
To try and set the story a bit, the family goes in flight from London, as we said, driving to Rome, and you become aware during that journey, which I must say in some sections is just kind of a fun old car trip, but in other sections it's quite distressing, and young Lawrence really feels like he's the little man of the family. He says at one point, as they're driving, we're like a secret army now. Nobody in these cars knows what we're doing.
Yes. No, I wanted very much that Lawrence shouldn't be a sort of cute child. I wanted him to be a character who's trying to control a situation which is actually, as it proves, really beyond his control.
Let me get you to read a section of this book so we get an idea of Lawrence's narrative voice. The family hasn't been in Rome that long, and their mother is taking them around sightseeing.
Mum said we would go to the Colosseum next, so I thought, oh yes, hurrah, because that was where they had lots of gladiator fights. But then Jemima got annoying. She said, I don't like this road with its old stones. They're slippery. She said, I'm staying here. I tried to help. I said, come on, Jemima, stop being such a big fat lazy. But it didn't work. She made her biting face and shook her fist at me. Mum looked tired. She said, all right, Lamekin, I'll carry you. So I thought, oh, good, that's all right then. But then the queue was really long, and when Mum asked how much the ticket cost, she said it was better from the outside. She said, let's have an ice cream instead. I was annoyed. I said, but I don't want an ice cream. I want to go in the Colosseum. But she got them anyway. Mine was strawberry, so we all sat on a wall, and when I ate it, I felt a bit better, actually. I didn't mind so much about the Colosseum after all.
You know, there are some lovely scenes of particular wonderful moments of spontaneity and sharing between mother and son that I just treasure. Staying up all night on watch together. They're worried that the father's going to come in the middle of the night, so they stay up all night and watch television.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to bring across, is that it's quite a tricky situation or an alarming story. But at the same time, I wanted to bring across the fact that actually, in some ways, they're having a great time, too. Children are very versatile. They can find, I think, happiness in places that maybe us older people couldn't really manage. So,
at some point, the mother of the family becomes worried and begins to see signs that perhaps her estranged husband is stalking the family, and she becomes quite fearful. And then at some point, you begin to wonder if the signs add up.
Well, I think we get I hope people will get a sense that something's going on here which isn't quite right at all.
The fulcrum of the story goes from the family's apprehension about the father finding them to the reader's concern that the mother might just be daft.
Yes, that she's got some real problems. That was one of the things that interested me about the child's narrative point of view, is that he is going to be drawn, he's really just going to see his mother as perfectly reliable and fantastic, regardless of any evidence, regardless of what's going on.
Yeah, and again, without giving away any plot points, his mother does the right thing for the family in the end.
Yes. No, in fact, I wanted very much for her to be an admirable mother. All she's doing is trying to look after her children and protect them. The only villain really in this story is that she doesn't see the world as it is. People who've read the book sometimes are harder on the mother than I expected people would be.
I don't want to press this too much, but are there some similarities between people who are paranoid and fiction writers?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. I mean, the fact is, if people who are paranoid, their real problem is that they're thinking most of their days about things that aren't necessarily there, and that's exactly what fiction writers have to do to make a living. The only difference is that fiction writers, one hopes, are slightly better at tuning out occasionally from what they're thinking about that isn't there.
Your mother, I have read, wrote the, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, the Moog the Cat books?
That's right, yeah.
I love those books.
Right.
With a big orange cat. We read the books to our children.
That's great.
They're classics in Britain.
Yes.
You, in a sense, grew up with a mother that was accustomed to inhabiting the minds and even the voices of children.
Yeah, in fact, she wrote three autobiographical novels, and the first of which is about her childhood. She was born in Germany in the 20s. Parents were Jewish, and she left in 1933. So that was her story. In fact, my father wrote as well. He wrote screenplays. So my grandfathers both wrote, so I think in a way I was doomed.
Mr. Neal, thanks so much.
That was great. I really enjoyed it.
Matthew Neal, his new novel is When We Were Romans.
We turn now to Cuba in the 1950s, where you could hear this on the radio at 10 o'clock every night.
Bacardí, la bebida cubana que alegra al mundo entero, presenta De Fiesta con Bacardí.
Party with Bacardi was the hit show presented by the premier Cuban company Bacardi Rum. It was an era when Cuba was the tourist capital of the Caribbean, an island of tropical delights, nightclubs, and casinos. NPR correspondent Tom Gelton has written a new book. It's called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. It's about the Bacardi family and the family's fortunes, which he writes have been intertwined with Cuba's ever since Cuba's wars for independence from Spain during the mid-1800s when the company was founded.
Rum, up until that period, was really, you'd have to say, it was a man's drink, and it was a rough man's drink. I mean, it was drunk by sailors and, you know, buccaneers, and was a very harsh in its taste. And Facundo Bacardi, the founder of the Bacardi Rum Company, decided to make rum a much lighter drink, one that would be enjoyed by a broader group of consumers, and one that could be mixed with other things. And, of course, Coca-Cola became famous, and the daiquiri and so forth.
And the thread of revolution starts with the son of the founder of Bacardi, who was involved in Cuba's war of independence from Spain in the 19th century.
Right, Renee. That's Emilio Bacardi, who's the first Bacardi born in Cuba, was arrested twice and exiled to Spain for years on end. He is the original person that intertwined this kind of entrepreneurial identity as the president of Bacardi Rum with this nationalist political identity as one of the real patriots of the Cuban independence movement.
So how do these two things mesh, if they do at all, with how Bacardi was run as a company putting out quite a famous product, popular as a party drink?
It's interesting that in the late 19th century, just as the Bacardi family was deeply involved in this anti-Spanish struggle, they were at the same time trying to court favor with the Spanish crown and actually were named as the purveyor to the royal household. One of the ways that they really established their reputation as a Cuban company was by emphasizing their patriotic credentials and their close association with Cuba. One of their first advertising slogans, Renee, was "The one that has made Cuba famous." And this was because many American tourists came to Cuba, and one of the things they enjoyed doing in the 1920s and 1930s and after was to drink rum. And so Bacardi became associated with Cuba in the mind of tourists, in the minds of Cubans, both for its political profile and for its contribution to sort of the cultural image of Cuba.
So then it was a natural, Tom, that this family would support the revolution in the 50s led by Fidel Castro?
You're right. The Bacardi relationship with the Cuban Revolution was, in many ways, a sort of a carryover of 100 years of involvement in, you know, what they regarded as progressive causes in Cuba and Cuban nationalistic movements. When Fidel Castro came to power in 1959, there was no Cuban company more closely associated with the revolution than the Bacardi Rum Company. Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of Bacardi Rum at that time, gave tens of thousands of dollars of his own money to buy weapons for Castro's rebels, as did other members of the Bacardi family. And it was really a year and a half after Fidel was in power that the Bacardis finally turned against him, and it came only after Fidel expropriated all their properties in Cuba. This was in October 1960, and when almost all the Bacardis then went into exile.
Tom, tell us the story of the Bacardi family member who actually plotted or hoped to attack Castro's Cuba.
Right, Renee. This is Pepin Bosch, the Bacardi chief and the same businessman who was so close to the revolutionary movement in the 1950s and then, of course, turned against it. His son, Carlos Bosch, living in exile in South Florida in the early 1960s, had this idea of starting an air freight business. But then for some reason, he couldn't get the requisite permissions from the U.S. aviation authorities to go ahead with his business. And finally, he says to his father, Pepin Bosch, "For some reason, I can't get the approval to get this business going. I have no idea what's the problem." And his father says, maybe it's the plane I'm keeping in Costa Rica. Pepin Bosch then proceeds to tell him that he has bought a B-26 bomber and he is looking for someone to fly it on bombing missions to Cuba. In fact, it never happened. He was never able to find anyone to fly that mission. But it's just an example of one of the many sabotage activities that were hatched in those first crazy years after Fidel came to power. And the Bacardis, as leading members of the Cuban exile community, were involved in a good number of them.
But the Bacardis did continue to do in exile quite well, didn't they? In fact, in some respects, even better.
That's really true, Renee. I mean, partly it reflects some very far-sighted decisions they made in the 1950s at a time when their biggest enemy was Batista, the Cuban dictator, and they actually worried that because of their political profile in Cuba in the 1950s, the Batista regime might move against them. And so you saw in the 1950s the creation of independent companies outside Cuba. And this made it much easier for the Bacardis to reorganize without their Cuban assets, without their Cuban headquarters.
What is the likelihood that in a post-Castro era, the Bacardi family and Bacardi rum will return to Cuba?
Again, one of the things about this whole Bacardi story is that there is a deep Cuban identity in this company, and it is a family company, Renee. To this day, even though it's worth billions and billions of dollars, it's still almost entirely owned by the Bacardi family. And so you would see the Bacardis then going back to Cuba in a way sort of representative of all that Cuban exile capital, Cuban exile money that could conceivably be made available in the rebuilding of Cuba. Just as the Bacardis have been a big force in Cuba for over a century, I think we cannot at all discount the possibility that they could be a force in Cuba in the future.
Tom, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, Renee.
NPR's Tom Gelton is the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the Biography of a Cause. Read an excerpt from the book and view a gallery of vintage Bacardi ads at our website, npr.org.
Sure. What story do you want?
From 1958 until the 1970s, Jim Kopp told children's stories. He didn't write children's books, but he and his business partner, Ed Brown, created, performed, and recorded his stories in a series of children's records. Now here's a short take from a story called Martha Matilda O'Toole.
Martha Matilda O'Toole went skipping off to school, but as she was turning to go through the gate, discovered that she had forgotten her slate. Thought Martha, the teacher won't like it a bit. I'd better go get it, my mind, she did.
Martha Matilda O'Toole and two other of Jim Kopp's tales have been combined into a new book for children, complete with illustrations and an accompanying CD. It's called Jim Kopp, Will You Tell Me a Story? Our ambassador to the world of children's literature, Daniel Pinkwater, joins us from his home.
Scott!
Yes.
I have one thing to say. No, I have two things to say.
Okay.
Maybe more.
Yeah.
The first thing to say is I am wary of books that come with CDs. And I shy away from music recordings specially made for children. In general, they give me the pip. When you and I did a children's radio program a few years ago, we gave them Fats Waller and Louis Armstrong, and I think we did right.
Yeah.
So here's a book with a CD and music specially made for children, and it is great.
Now, you knew him, I gather.
I know his work. And here's the thing. Jim Kopp and his partner, Ed Brown, started producing these records in the 50s.
He was like a cabaret performer, wasn't he?
He was a cabaret performer and an intelligence officer in the war, and then he wrote a society column in a Los Angeles paper, so figure him out. And so he started doing this in his house, using three home tape recorders, and Brown played some of the characters, designed the albums, and they would take a suitcase and go around and hand sell the records to upscale stores like Neiman Marcus and Bergdorf Goodman and FAO Schwartz, and they kept this up for at least 10 years.
Oh, my gosh. well, of course, now you and I usually read from the book, but we have the Kopp and Brown recording.
It would be a shanda or a scandal or a shame for you and I to read it when we have the actual sound.
All right, but let's listen and maybe talk a little bit about one of the stories here, Miss Goggins and the Gorilla.
Now, our story opens in the classroom of Miss Goggins, an incredibly nasty teacher.
Ugly, too, they point out.
Ugly, too. Mm-hmm. So she uses words like unruly, disobedient, and vituperative to describe the children. I love it, and kids love it when grown-up words appear in children's books. It sure takes me back to the Nettlehorst School on Broadway in Chicago.
Yes, Broadway and about Melrose?
Yep. Many of the teachers I had were very like Ms. Goggin.
So, can I spill the beans? A gorilla's in the classroom, right?
A gorilla shows up.
The huge animal came straight toward Ms. Goggins.
Get out of here. How dare you come into my room? You aren't a real gorilla. You are only Mr. Hobson, the manual training teacher, dressed up in a gorilla suit to fool us. Get out!
Well, I think he really is a gorilla, okay? I'm taking a look at the illustrations. He doesn't look like Mr. Hobson in a gorilla suit to me. I think he's really a gorilla. But the point of it is she kicks him out.
She pushes him. She shoves him. Not even a gorilla can stand up to Ms. Goggins.
Silence. That was not a real gorilla, and you are stupid children for thinking so.
I love her.
We've all had teachers like this. So she tries to continue the lessons, but you know what? The gorilla will not be held at bay. He comes crashing through the door.
And then,
said the gorilla through the door.
Silence, Mr. Hobson.
Said the gorilla, and he came suddenly crashing through the door. And with his hairy arm swinging, came straight for Miss Goggins.
I told you to get out of my room,
said Miss Goggins.
I shall report you to the principal.
Report me to the principal, said the gorilla, removing his false head. And who do you suppose he really was? He was the principal of the school himself.
All right. Turns out he was checking on the teachers, as he always did, in disguise once a year. And because she performed so miserably, he fires her.
And out the door she flew. And it was the last the children ever saw of her. Of course, such a thing could never happen nowadays, because there aren't any more teachers like Miss Goggins, are there, children?
I can see where I can see where these were very popular, and
still should be.
And now we've got a note to today's children who were growing up in a world of digital audio and YouTube and TiVo. The technology might sound a little bit primitive, or does it? On the other hand, does it sound charming?
It's not that primitive when you consider that it's one guy, and various kitchen appliances, kazoos, toy pianos, and 3 Ampex tape recorders in his living room.
How does the book part hold up here?
I think it's a handsome book. I think the illustrations are right in the groove. Apparently, Lindsay DuPont, the illustrator, grew up listening to the Jim. And the Jim Cop records came with little sort of like, I don't know what you call them, push-out or pop-out figures, and you could make a little cardboard theater. It was quite elaborate. The whole thing is in such good fun. I'm so pleased that we can call this to people's attention.
Daniel Pinkwater is the author of many fine books for children and for adults. His latest book is The Egacy. And by the way, you can find an installment of it on his website, pinkwater.com. You listening, Miss Goggins?
1,857 pages thick. And I'm glad I took it. It fits perfectly under the short leg of my pool table. It wasn't a history. I know because it had no plot, it wasn't a mystery. Because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when. But one of these days I'm gonna do it again. Yes, one of these days I'm gonna do it again.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.